take a moment to turn within to the silent place. I acknowledge your presence, God, within me, as me. I acknowledge your presence within every person who is here. I acknowledge your presence everywhere, and I am willing to hear what you would speak to me and to everyone. Amen. I've got two or three things that I'd like to read to you, and one of them is a poem. And when I was at university, I took a course in romantic literature, and I remember we studied this, and I thought, what is this all about? And today, I read this often, because it just talks to me. It's from a poem called Paracelsus by Robert Browning. And, you know, I think the more you begin to see that to think this way, the world starts to talk to you. Music starts to talk to you. Poetry starts. Novels. Everything starts to talk to you of what this thing is. And what this is talking about is God within. Truth is within ourselves. It takes no rise from outward things, whatever you may believe. There is an inmost center in us all where truth abides in fullness. And around wall upon wall, the gross flesh hems it in, this perfect clear perception, which is truth. A baffling and perverting carnal mesh binds it and makes all error. And to know rather consists in opening out a way whence the imprisoned splendor may escape, than in effecting entry for a light supposed to be without. Could be in the big book, couldn't it? It's saying it's within. It's bound by this carnal flesh. And our job consists in opening out a way whence the imprisoned splendor may escape. It sounds like step four, doesn't it? Where it says we have to get rid of the things that have been blocking us. You know, when I came in and I read that, I thought what it meant was the good stuff is out there. The men and Mike, I haven't forgotten about you, young man. I'm thinking, planning. And I thought, you know, the good stuff is out there. I didn't know what the blocks were, but I thought if I can get rid of the blocks, then I'm going to get that stuff into my life. That's not what he's saying. Truth is within us. You can take this poem and put love is within us. Wisdom is within us. Strength is within us. Power is within us. It's all here. As Chuck used to say, you already are everything that you can be. And you already know everything that you can know. And I thought, it was nice to listen to it, didn't have a clue what it meant. And here it is. Truth is within ourselves. It takes no rise from outward things, whatever you may believe. There is an inmost center in us all where truth abides in fullness, and so on. Anybody that wants a copy, it's up here. And it's a good little meditation anytime you want something different. I think that to me is just a proof that God is everywhere. Because, you know, when you can pick up poetry and pick up books and pick up whatever, and there is the message of the presence of God everywhere. I want to read you a paragraph from Bill Wilson, and then we'll get... Because step three says, I'm going to make a decision. And I personally, for a lot of years, didn't get the significance of this. It says, we make a decision. For an adult, a decision is an important event. I used to buy and sell houses. I made decisions. I didn't make a decision one day and the next day change my mind. I mean, think about how you do business. Not like a child motivated by your feelings. If you make a decision, don't you do this? That's what I used to do when I was deciding whether I would buy another house. I'd list all the pros and I'd list the cons. And when I sized them up, I would make a decision. Do I want to proceed and buy that house, or maybe the cons outweighed the pros and I said no. And if I did that, I made good decisions. So now we're asked to make a decision based on what we are convinced of. You know what? I make far fewer stupid decisions since I think about this. And I think what step three is really inviting me to is to take a look at what we've just been through. Step one, where I'm acknowledging I can't pull off life by myself. I have no power of my own. There is one who has all power, and it's not me, and it's not you either. So I have already gone through that process. I've gone through the process of step two, where I see I don't have the power to fix it. And then when my heart is open, that power comes in and does the absolutely incredible, takes from me the compulsion and the obsession. So I have some information. If I really think about that, am I willing then to make a decision? That decision does not say that I'm going to be good the rest of my life. God help us if it did. See, what it says is, I make a decision. The way I put it to myself is, I'm going to live different. Up to this point, it's all been me, me, me. It's all been what's good for me. What do I want? I don't care about you. I'm going to have life my way. And I think if I look at it that way, I don't think the book is asking us to do something that's just going to keep us stuck. You know, if I'm making a decision and I think that this means, you know, I've got to give this all over to God, I don't even know how that works. I don't know. All I know is that as the days go by, I can think different, I can act different, and I can do my life different. And sometimes I get off the path. I love little detours. And I can get back on. That, to me, is a good way to look at step three. I'm not a proponent of poor behavior. God help me. But I'm a proponent of reasonable expectation. And to think that I'm going to go from the way I lived and all of a sudden I'm just going to be, you know, have wings on and the way I go, that's crazy. It isn't going to happen. I haven't seen it happen to anybody, and it sure is not happening to me. It is a process, a day-by-day event, thought-by-thought, step-by-step, action-by-action. See, if I don't see that, all step three does is put me into another level of hating myself. You're such a loser. You say you're going to change and you don't change. You know what? These days I expect that there are some days I'm off the rails. And I just don't beat myself over the head anymore because it doesn't help. I know that God is within, and some days I go to sleep. And some days I think, yeah, God, you're there. And I say to myself, I don't care. I want to do it my way. You identify with that? And there are consequences for that, aren't there? You want to come and join me? He just did. Okay. See, the first requirement, he says, is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Think of it. We live on the planet with 6.8 billion others. And life has to go my way? I don't think so. This is madness. This is insanity. We come from different families. You know, if you're like our family, we come from the same family, we had the same parents, and many of us thought very different. We were quite unique. We were quite different. You think about it. You were raised that way, somebody else was raised. Who's right and who's wrong? Is your way better than mine? Or is, like, can we say a rose is better than a dandelion? If we believe that the life force is in the dandelion, why is the dandelion preferable to the rose? If we believe that the life force is in a cockroach, why is the cockroach something, a bug that we squeeze and kill, and we love a little chihuahua? Eh?
What?
Chihuahua. A chihuahua. Chihuahua. Or whatever. You know? It's the way we've been conditioned. You know, life is variety. So, he says that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Like, why won't you let me? Why won't you just realize I know best? Just do it my way, and we won't have any trouble. I'm good. I'll be nice to you as long as you do it my way. But don't misstep. See, and then he goes on to say, everybody would be pleased. I relate this to my sister Dora. Dora was injured at birth, and she couldn't learn as fast as other kids, so she was kept in grade 3 till she was 16. And I hated the world. And I hated the brothers and sisters who didn't fix it, and I hated God who didn't fix it. And, you know, he talks about how we act. In trying to make these arrangements, we may be kind, considerate, and quite virtuous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, we may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. It's all about what I see, the way I see it, and the way it has to go. See? What usually happens, the show doesn't come off, and we pick up the ante. And isn't that just the truth? We exert ourselves more. And in that comes this wonderful delusion. Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of the world if only he manages well? God, sometimes, you know, when I'm in trouble, when I'm suffering the consequences of my actions, I think, boy, next time I'm just going to do it right. You ever get that thought? Why was I so stupid? Why did I do that? Next time I will do it right, and then I won't get into this trouble. Now we come to some really important stuff where he says selfishness, self-centeredness. That, we think, is the root of our troubles. That's what Chuck Chamberlain tried to tell me all the time. You think you're separate. You think you're different. You think you're unique. You think you're special. You think all kinds of things. Which reminds me, there are two words that I really think we should take out of the language unless we use them correctly. You know, and that is, I don't feel worthy. Yes, I do feel worthy. If I believe that God is within me, I'm always worthy. I'm not worthy because of what I do as a person. I'm worthy because of who I am. And that's why that question is so important. Who do you think you are? Are you just a body? Are you just a human being? Are you running around the planet trying to do some good? And is that what makes you worthy? See, and I think special comes into that category. Of course I'm special. Because God, I'm a unique being. So are you, and so is everybody. Not based on our bank accounts and on our appearance and on our houses and on our stuff and on the jobs that we do, etc. So he goes on to say, the root of our troubles is selfishness. driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. And they sometimes hurt us. And he says, sometime in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later put us in a position to be hurt. See? This step I like to do right from the book. I couldn't say it better. We make decisions, and some of those decisions have a long arm. You know, sometimes when I think about my life and I think about other people's lives and I think, and pardon me, it's the best example I know, so I'm going to use it. At some point I say, well, you know, I don't have children and I don't have grandchildren. How does that come about? I had an abortion. I'm not proud of that. But I think about this often when I think that. I made decisions based on self. And the long arm of that is that here at this age when I should have grandchildren and whatever, I don't. It's not God's fault. And often when I think of things that are hurting me, I can think of that situation I talked about last night. I had some input into that, in the way I dealt with situations and people. And so everything, you see, I believe that at some time in the past we made decisions based on self. And sometimes I'm not even awake to the fact that I am doing things based on self. Because I can kid myself that I have all kinds of good motivations when really what I want is my way. I don't feel good and I want you to make me feel good and so I'll do whatever. So he says that we think our troubles are basically of our own making. This just takes my breath away every time I read it. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. See? This is the preparation for step four. Anybody that says this book isn't put together well, I don't agree. Everything is leading us now. So he goes on to say, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. That's very strong language. It kills us. God makes that possible. I'll leave you to interpret that as you think, that what that might mean. And there often seems no way of getting rid of self-will, of self, without his aid. There's a statement at the end of that paragraph. See, he says many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we couldn't live up to them. This statement really hits me hard. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own. What do you mean? I can't even get rid of self by myself. If that doesn't put us squarely in the middle of believing in a power bigger than ourselves. Because he says, neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own. We had to have God's help. And I wonder how that help shows up. I think it shows up in precisely the events of life that are in the things that are in my life today. They are absolutely perfectly geared to getting rid of that portion of self. You know, when we talk about letting go and letting God, I think that's really what it means. I don't know how to grow my soul. I don't know how to do that. But I'm here in this moment with the circumstances in my life as they are, just as you are with the circumstances that are in your life. And that's what I think this is getting to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own. We had to have God's help. And I think that's by saying. That's why, where I, before when I wrote down some of the pitfalls, one of the pitfalls is, if I don't see that, I don't surrender to the present moment. I don't accept what's in my life. And I think it was Carl Rogers who said, until you get to the point in your life where you accept exactly the way it is, you can't start to change. And as soon as you accept what's in your life and perfectly accept it, then the process of change can begin. And I believe that's true. So he says, this is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. I don't like to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in the drama of life, God was going to be our director, our principal, and our father. You know, if you think about a movie director, the people on that stage had better do what that director says if they want an Oscar. The director has the overall view. When things go wrong in my life, all I sometimes think about is me and how I'm affected and how I feel about it. There are a whole lot of people in any given situation. Isn't that right? I'm not the only one. That's why, going back to Fred in More About Alcoholism, he says spiritual principles would solve all my problems. And I think one of the spiritual principles is, I am not the only one in a situation. And though I whatever is happening, there are other people who are impacted by what is going on in a given situation. So he says, God is the director, he's the principal. You know, in the days when I was teaching, whether I was in college or high school, there was always a principal, and the principal set the pace for the school with the help of the teachers. But basically, the principal, you know, made the programs and all that kind of stuff. We're the agents. He is the father. And I think that word has been misunderstood, because people have had this anthropomorphic version of God. God showing up in the person in the form of their earthly fathers. I don't believe that. I may be wrong about this, but I think that the concept here, because it's one that Jesus used, he said, the Father and I are one. He meant the life giver. And if we think of this, the Father is the life giver. There was a time in history where the woman was not considered to contribute anything to the child. She was kind of like an oven. And the man put in the sperm, and from that, the child was born. It was the father's identity that went into that child. And so I think, when I look at that now, I think when he says God is the father, that means God is the life giver. A dog father begets dogs. A cat father begets cats. A human father begets humans. And if God is the father, then I am made in that image and likeness. And it fits with what it says in the chapter to the agnostics, where it says, either God is everything or God is nothing. And if God is everything, then I'm made out of it. And that even works with that good book, which isn't General Service approved. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. You know, that is such a big statement, it just absolutely takes my breath away. God is the director, God is the principal, and God is the father. If I can just get that ego, that false I sense out of the way, as step three is requiring me to do. You know what a keystone is? You know, I'm going next month to St. Louis. And I love the arch in St. Louis. And the very first time I went was a couple of years ago. And they showed this wonderful, you seen it, Bob? that wonderful movie where they showed how they built the arch. And they built this, I think it's seven, it's huge. And the two arms are standing there waiting for this keystone. And the arms are going to get locked into the keystone, and it has to be done perfectly so that everything fits. That is going to be the strength of the arch. And the man was explaining to us that the day that they got the helicopter, the first time they got the helicopters, they had built the keystone, and the arch, arms of the arch were standing there. And when they took it out, the temperature of the keystone was not the same temperature as the arch, and they had to make sure that the temperature was the same. So when they put the keystone down and locked the arms in, it was a perfect match. And the strength of that, I just love to stand there. And you can go up in little train, and I love to walk up in the keystone and say, I'm walking in the keystone, I'm walking in the keystone, remembering what step three says. That this is the keystone. And it says, this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. God, I want to be free. I want to be free of my false self. I want to be free of fear. I want to be free of trying to control the world. I want to be free of always feeling vulnerable and not knowing what's going around the next corner. Is that a bird? Is he making whoopee? Sounds like it. Pardon? Thinking. I've got whoopee on the mind, I think. Okay. Look at the promises. You know, we read the promises at the end of step nine. I love these promises. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Powerful, powerful statement. How many times haven't you thought, I don't like the employer I have? As a matter of fact, somebody said that to me yesterday. They want a new boss. And here, we get a new boss. Instead of having the ego and the false self as our boss, we've got this new employer. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. He's insistent, isn't he? Woo! Or she. Could be. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, these are promises at the end of three. As we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we don't have to wait to step 11. We began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Do you remember how many times in life you've said, I wish I could do that over? And here it says, we were reborn. We get to do life the way we feel we really want to. He says we were now at step three. And then we have that beautiful prayer. And I'm going to ask you, when I finish this, for those who would like to, if we would take step three together. He says we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready. And I think it's an entirely reasonable way to look, that we're going to make the decision based on the pros and cons. Yeah, I'm ready to dedicate myself one more time to serving God. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. I always find when we get to this, when I'm doing the steps with somebody, we get on our knees, and it's really a powerful experience. Or with a, you know, with a group when we do this together. But he says, it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. So, if you're willing, it's 1:45, so I'm on track, and if you're willing, could we say the third step for those of you who would? Say the third step prayer together, and I would remind you that there is no amen at the end of that prayer. And there's no amen at the end of that prayer because it says this decision wouldn't mean much if we didn't then get into a vigorous program of action. Because amen means it is finished. And it's not finished. It's just beginning. So, if you will, could we say the third step prayer together, please? Do we want to get in a circle? Do we just want to stay where you are? You know, sometimes when I do this, especially, I feel I'm talking to those who already know. So, again, I suggest to you that it is your responsibility, not mine, to see what's in your life. Because I don't believe that there's any life that is totally free of difficulty of one kind and another, or that there isn't a place that I can do something better, that I can do something from a deeper God consciousness, because really I think that's all there is. And I think sometimes if we're not careful, we've got a car in the garage, we've got a roof over our head, we've got a chicken in the pot, life is kind of moving along okay. And if we're not careful, we begin to think, well, you know, I've kind of got it made. Trust me, this too shall pass. And pass probably more quickly than you would like it to pass, or light more quickly than you think it will pass. That's been my experience over and over again. So, anyway, what we're going to do now is I'm not going to go over the mechanics of how to do the step. I have a few observations ago that the head and the heart can get only as much as the hiney can accommodate. And the hiney has to move. So, we'll talk a little bit about 4 and 5, and then we'll have small group at 2:30, we'll have coffee, and we'll reassume at 2:45. To talk about 6 and 7. We want to leave lots of time. I understand we're having a beautiful dinner, so we want to leave lots of time for that. So, I talked briefly about my feeling about step 3. The one thing that I do not want to do is come out of doing these steps feeling like a loser. I know something about myself. I'm very imperfect. I know that, you know, somewhere in step 3 it says we thought we could wrest satisfaction out of this world. Gotta get back here. If only we manage well. And there have been times when I have done things that I have found painful. And I think, like, why couldn't I be careful? Why did I have to do that? Like, couldn't I see that coming? You ever thought that? Hello?
Yes?
Yes? Okay. And I just don't think that's the way life works. I don't want to live as if I've always got to be tense and wondering, am I doing the right thing? I just don't think that's a good way to live. I think it's a good way to live, to know who I am, that I'm a God being, and that's what I'm here to live like, that I'm here to think of you that way, that I'm here to see myself that way, and I know I'm going to make mistakes. And I know that there are going to be people who, you know, there are certain realities. There are people who don't like me. I can't imagine why, but there are people probably who don't like me. And once in a while that comes up, and I'm sure there are people who from time to time don't like you and don't agree with what you do or what you say. Those are the realities of life. You just might as well take the corset off your old ideas and just accept that's the way life rolls. And if I understand that, I understand something about step three, that the self in me, one of the great saints put it this way. He said he figured that if his self died 10 minutes after he did, he'd be grateful. The false self, that is. You don't find that humorous? Usually people find that very humorous. And, you know, that's been my experience. There are times I feel really spiritual, and I feel I'm really in tune with everything, and then there are times where that is not the case, and it's a struggle to do the things, or I really have to discipline myself to do the things that I'm talking about. Again, I say, I find that what there are, you figure out what is it that helps you. One of the things that helps me is I do a detailed step one before I begin the day. And then I do my prayer and meditation and that kind of thing. But if I don't remember who I am and how I am, life can get really difficult. So, we get to step four. If I have made the decision that I'm going to walk a different way, I'm going to try not to walk according to the false self. I'm going to try and walk according to that power that has been revealed to me through being powerless over alcohol, that power that has been revealed to me through the compulsion and the obsession being taken. And now I come to that. I've done the pros and cons, and I've made a decision. Not a wishy-washy, maybe I'll do it, but a decision that I'm going to move forward trying to live a new way of life. Common sense says if that is the case, then I want to take a look at where am I, how am I living my life? That's really what step four is about, I think. What is wrong? What am I doing that is off the track? What kind of thoughts am I thinking? How am I engaging with people? How am I not engaging with people? Am I too busy? What is it that I'm doing that is contrary to the way I think God would have me live? There are 1,001 questions. But I think the genius, the real genius of this whole system is the way Bill has laid out step four. And it's always my opinion, and I think most of you would agree, that the hand of God, the heart of God, guided him when this book was written, and through the input of the other members. Because one of the things he says is, we have to face and be rid of the things that have been blocking us. As I told you before, I thought blocking meant I didn't know quite what, but the good was out there, and then if I got rid of those blocks, the good would come running. And I don't think that's the way it works at all. I think it's much more like the spider. You know, the spider builds his nest, and he knows it all comes from within. he doesn't have the consciousness to have all the self-doubt and all the stuff that we have. But we have lived according to self, self-centeredness. I don't think it's by chance that Bill says the root of the problem is self. And so, depending on how our lives have gone, who we are, you know, we come here with those difficulties. So, we're going to face and be rid of the things that have been blocking us. What blocks me? What keeps that great reality from expressing through me? It's those old ideas. It's hatred. It's guilt. It's all that negative stuff that says I'm separate. How am I going to get at that? I think back over my life, and I think back over those 32 hospitalizations in one psych ward or another. I think back of all the therapy and all the kinds of therapy I've had and all the people who wanted to help me. And I come here sicker than ever. And then I come and I do this fourth step. It's brilliant. You know, and I've seen it over and over again, and so have you. We look at three areas of our lives. I had a person come to me one time. He had been in therapy, honest to God, for 18 years. Now, I would say that's kind of highly unsuccessful when you're in therapy for 18 years. And so what do? We look at three areas. And there are just a couple of ideas that I want to point out. He says we searched out the flaws that had been blocking us and that had been causing us difficulty. If you look at your life, I think, yes, we have a method for doing this step four, but step four also is really revealing so that you get an idea of who you are. I hear people say all the time, I've got to find out who I am. What's to find out? Like, I think that's just another therapeutic, the false self saying we're going to keep ourselves stuck on ourselves. I think the question really is, who do I think I am? And I think that I'm a God being, and I think that I live in what seemingly is this body. I live in this spacesuit, and I'm not always awake, and I haven't been awake, and I make mistakes. That's who I am. What else really do I need to know? I need to know the things in me that are the flaws that had been blocking me. And being convinced that self manifested in various ways. You know, about 3 years ago, that statement hit me, and it hit me hard. That part of what step four really does, it gets us to see our basic flaws. I don't think we have 1,000 flaws. I think we have ways of dealing with life, and each one of us has got a different one. And this being convinced that self manifested in various ways, I'll tell you what I learned about myself in the last couple of years, where it has really come to the fore, is this. There's a part of me that is afraid. There's a part of me that feels I can't. And that's right from childhood. And there's a part of me that then all my life has gone out looking for somebody who's going to fix it because I can't. I learned that in childhood. And you can say, well, you know, Mildred, you know, that's a long time ago. How come you're dragging that? Hasn't the program worked? Of course the program has worked. You wake up to things when you wake up to things. And because we're in the program doesn't mean that all that childhood stuff, and I'll talk about that later, gets taken away. Because I think that's where the self really manifests. So me, I get fearful about things. And then I think I can't fix it. I go looking for somebody who's going to fix it. And to get you to fix it, I sell my soul. That's how I do life. And then that's where it is. And then that comes to bite me in the ass. That's really what happens. And I could take my whole fourth step and I could analyze it really from that perspective. You see? And now what I've seen is that fear manifested in various ways is one of the things I'm dealing with right now. You might say, well, you know, 37 years sober, you shouldn't have fear. Why not? You know, the book says we're not after perfection. We're after getting better. We're after improving and getting to know ourselves. So we look at our resentments. And it's here that Bill says liquor was but the symptom. You know, sometimes people get very nervous when I say that. But I think that we need to acknowledge that. Liquor was my solution. A wrong solution, but it was my solution. And did it create problems? Absolutely. But that's why when you put the liquor aside, you know, I'd said this before, putting the liquor aside, I got rid of the problems that the liquor created, but I didn't get rid of the problems of what was going on in here, you see. And that's where the difficulty is, and that's what I have to take a look at. And that's why I think the resentment is such a big deal. You know, resentment means to re-feel or to re-experience. It comes from that prefix and an infinitive in Latin, which means to feel again, and re means again. I don't think there's anything wrong with anger. I think anger is a natural response to things going not right. But many of us have never learned to deal with anger. We have never learned to express anger. We have never learned, and oftentimes people have been told, don't you show your temper to me or I'll give you something, you know, to really be disturbed about. And so what we've learned is how to manipulate. I won't show you what I feel because you might not like me if I show you what I feel. And we suppress all that stuff and we've got a cauldron going on within. And we replay that stuff and replay that stuff. That's really what resentment is. That's why he says it's the number one offender. See, why is that such a big deal? Because I don't believe that you are the solution to my life. That's the problem. And when I act as if you are the solution for what is wrong with me, then I'm going to have that stuff churning inside. I think we get back to what I consider the whole theme of what these steps are about, that through God consciousness, we deal with things different. Through God consciousness, we learn to stand on our own two feet. And if there is something that is unjust or not right or whatever, we learn to speak up instead of just burying it because they won't like me if I say something, you see? And I think that's really what is at the root of every resentment that I've ever had. You don't seem to want to fix me, and so I'm angry at you, and I bury that, and then I pretend there is nothing wrong, and before we know it, we've got a big problem here. And I love the way he said, you know, he suggests we lay it out. A person who, strange for a person like that to go to a convent, eh? But nevertheless, that's where it took me. And as I went through my life, I began to see what really went on inside and how I became that person who had to please, who had to do for others because I felt I didn't have the power to grow up. And that was a big part of my fourth step, to get to the point where I could say, I'm not second rate because I live in a woman's body. And you're not God Almighty because you live in a man's body, you see. And I kind of think that that's where our journey goes. And I often tell women, I think a lot of this stuff that we talk about in relationship, I just think it's trying to fix the outside. I think we have to fix the inside and stand up. I do not believe that our relationships are going to be improved because we manipulate one another. You know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Get to know what those men want, and then you give them what they want, and then they'll give you what, and then you're going to have a peaceful relationship. I don't think so. See? I don't think we're going to have a peaceful relationship by tearing men down. You know, sometimes I hear women say, oh, he's so unavailable. How available are you, honey? See? You know, I think if we can understand something, I realize that men have been programmed just like we have. And I'm not saying we've all had exactly the same programming, but I do think we've had programming. I certainly have. And I had to get past the fact that I'm nothing because I'm a girl. And that the way to get things done was to find a man. And all the men that I ever went with, they were rich, they were handsome, they were popular. They were the kind of men who I thought had stuff that I couldn't get myself. And young man, you come here and I'll give you what you want, and then you'll give me what I want, and then everything's going to be fine. And it doesn't work that way. And I think, too, that, and I've never had a man disagree with me on this, and I give lots of men's retreats, and that men often assume something, too, that because it's the way we're conditioned, that because they're men, certain things happen in life. They have power that women don't have. And I don't think that's the way it works. I think that men have to learn, I shouldn't say have to learn, that the challenge is to learn that I am somebody because God lives as me. And that my role on the planet is defined by society somewhat, but I don't have to follow that. And I can have feelings, and I can act in certain ways, and that I, as a woman, do not have to feel second rate to any man, because my dignity is not based on some outer conditioning. It's based on the belief that God lives as me, and that, therefore, I need to stand up and be counted. I didn't learn how to live that way. And, you know, I'm learning to live that way now. And not to blame that my life looks the way it does because of what some man did or didn't do. I don't know if that's helpful to you. But I'm telling you, it changed a lot of things for me. And a lot of men have told me they see the world different in their relationships. And I know that some women, I certainly am a lot happier thinking like that. And that doesn't mean that we don't look at our sex conduct, have lots of that to take a look at. But this added a whole new dimension to how I grew up. And then, of course, we take that. I want to read you something that somebody sent me. You know, Bob was talking about self-centeredness and his experiences with talking on that subject. This is about lovemaking. And it just kind of strikes me. Wish I had known this some time ago. Lovemaking can and should be a joyful act, an act of surrender to the divine in yourself and in your partner. Physical love is no less beautiful than other forms of love, nor can it be separated from them. If you view physical love as unholy, you will probably experience it that way, not because it is, but because you perceive it that way. Isn't that a great piece? Chuck Chamberlain used to talk a lot about that. He used to talk a lot about what goes on in the bedroom between men and women and how we can be very selfish about that kind of thing. So, now we're going to have some small groups, and you can talk about your sexuality, or you can talk about steps 1, 2, and 3, whatever is select a leader. and we'll go till 2:30, and then we'll have a coffee break, and then we'll come back for 6 and 7, okay? So,